Deep Impact returns for a Space 3-for-1 this week on Planetary Radio. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Public Radio's travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan. You remember Deep Impact, right? After all, it has only been 2 years since it fired a ball of copper at Comet Tempel 1, scoring a direct hit that sent shockwaves through the planetary science community. Back then, we talked with Principal Investigator Mike Ahern about his mission's spectacular fireworks show and the science it delivered. Well, last week, Deep Impact struck again. NASA announced that the spacecraft will complete 2 additional missions rolled into 1. And we've got Mike back to provide the details. He'll join us right after our space headlines and Emily Lakdawalla's Q&A. Shakespeare in space. Verily, as you'll hear later today when Bruce Betts welcomes a special guest for this week's What's Up session. That's also when we'll give away another Planetary Radio t-shirt. Time for those headlines. It wasn't just Deep Impact that got a new lease on life. The Stardust spacecraft, having successfully delivered its package of cometary and interstellar particles to Earth, has been given a new job. And get this, Stardust will visit Comet Tempel 1, the same ball of ice and dust that Deep Impact made a deep impact in. If you caught last week's show, you know that the Dawn mission to asteroids Vesta and Ceres was about to enter a very narrow launch window. NASA just announced that window has been closed for the time being. Just too many minor problems to deal with before Dawn had to make way for the fixed launch of the Phoenix Mars lander. But as we heard from Dawn's project system engineer Mark Raymond, that window will open wide again in September. Emily's on vacation, so we're bringing back a classic Q&A segment, one of my favorites. You'll want to breathe a sigh of relief after you've heard it. I'll be right back with Mike Ahern.
Hi, I'm Emily Lakdawalla with questions and answers. A listener asked, will the sun explode and consume the planets? Our sun is not large enough to end its life in a supernova. However, in several billion years, the sun's core will run low on hydrogen fuel and begin burning helium instead. At the same time, hydrogen fusion will move to higher levels in the sun. Heat from the rising tide of hydrogen fusion will cause the outer layers of the sun to expand and turn our yellow star into a red giant. As the sun expands, it'll envelop Mercury, then Venus, but probably not Earth. Still, the weather forecast for Earth isn't good. The sun will be 1,000 times more energetic, blowing away Earth's atmosphere and cooking its surface into a crispy hell. But bad news for Earth may be good news for other places in the solar system. Stay tuned to Planetary Radio to find out more.
Now we know what happens when you put Dixie and Epic together. First things first, Dixie stands for Deep Impact Extended Investigation, while Epic is Extrasolar Planet Observation and Characterization. The interesting thing is that both missions were proposed for the Deep Impact spacecraft. NASA figured, what the heck, one spacecraft, why not call it one mission? So EPOXI, or Epoxy, was born, and Principal Investigator Mike Ahern is once again a very busy guy. Mike is the Distinguished Professor of Astronomy at the University of Maryland, who led Deep Impact's successful investigation of Comet Tempel 1, including the interplanetary cherry bomb that went off on July 4, 2005, when Deep Impact's impactor made a good-sized crater in the comet. We spoke to Mike in his College Park, Maryland office just a couple of days after he and we learned that Epoxy had been approved. Mike, thanks very much for joining us once again on Planetary Radio, and congratulations on what I think may be the first 3-for-1 in space exploration.
Thanks, Matt. Indeed, we hope this really is 3 missions out of a single spacecraft. Going to take the Deep Impact spacecraft that flew past Tempel 1 and do 2 more missions with it. First, we'll study some extrasolar planets, and then we'll fly by Comet Botan in December of 2008.
You just got this news on July 3rd, the day before Independence Day, or at least that's when it was announced to the public.
Yes, I got the news about 2 hours before it was announced to the public, one day before the anniversary of Deep Impact's initial event.
You know, that's right. I completely forgot, even though, of course, we were all out there at the Planetary Society's live event during that amazing confrontation with that comet. This is interesting in other ways as well, and it is certainly presenting you with some challenges. Can you give us some history on what were two separate proposals, both of which were proposed to NASA as discovery missions for use of the Deep Impact spacecraft?
Sure. We back even before we launched Deep Impact, we had thought about other targets that we could use for an extended mission to go to another comet. But NASA held us off until after the successful encounter with Temple 1 before deciding we could go ahead and do formal proposals. But then we realized there was a great use for Deep Impact to study extrasolar planets, and Greg Deming at Goddard Space Flight Center approached me about writing a proposal to do that. So we wrote two separate proposals, one proposal to do his mission, on which I would be a co-investigator, and several of our other team members would be, and then a separate proposal to fly by Comet Botan. We submitted these two proposals independently to NASA's Discovery Announcement of Opportunity. After they reviewed the proposals, NASA came back and said, "We like both of these proposals. We would now like you to do a concept study report, sometimes called a Phase A study, for a combined mission to show that you can combine successfully the operations and the budgets of the two separate proposals into a single project." And this is important both for NASA's budget management and for making sure that there's only one voice speaking for the spacecraft. That turned out to be myself as PI of the combined project, and Drake Deming, the head of the EPIC investigation, is the deputy PI for the project. So we combined the two and wrote a concept study report that was submitted at the end of March, and then we had a site visit from the review team in May. Then on the 3rd of July, they announced the decision.
And when they made that announcement, even though it wasn't mentioned by NASA in the press release, I mean, they had high praise for this combined Dixie and EPIC mission, now renamed Epoxy. Glued them together, one might say. What the press release didn't mention is that they said, "Okay, Mike, you can do this, but you've got 25% less money than you asked for to pull it off."
That's correct. It was NASA's opinion that we had not reduced costs as much as they thought we should have been able to by combining the two missions. The two missions, each one standing alone, were a bit over $25 million each. When we combined them, we proposed $40 million, and the NASA analysis said that we should have been able to combine them for something less, something in the vicinity of $30 million. So they have told us to get the budget down to that, and that, in fact, is the first order of business now that we've been selected, is to get the budget down to $30 million while still preserving some reserves for contingencies.
And you're not exactly sure, I guess, how you're going to do that yet, because you have yet to talk to your colleagues at JPL and elsewhere.
That's correct. I will be going out to JPL next Monday to talk to them about where we can cut costs to bring the price down.
Now, we should point out, both of these were already very inexpensive missions, particularly as compared to what it would have cost to do these as original new missions with new spacecraft. I mean, after all, here you have this spacecraft functioning well that's already up there.
Yes. The cap for new missions proposed at the same time we proposed our extended missions was a factor of 10 higher than our proposal. The cap was, I believe, $450 million. I don't know what the proposed missions came in at offhand, but they were in the hundreds of millions of dollars for single missions. Now, the new missions have the advantages of doing new science, but we think that our approach of using existing spacecraft is just incredibly cost-effective for getting exciting science done.
Micah Hearn, principal investigator for the Deep Impact mission, and now for the new Epoxy mission. I'll be back with him in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here. I hope you're enjoying Planetary Radio. We put a lot of work into this show and all our other great Planetary Society projects. I've been a member since the disco era. Now I'm the Society's vice president. And you may well ask, why do we go to all this trouble? Simple. We believe in the PB&J, the passion, beauty, and joy of space exploration. You probably do too, or you wouldn't be listening. Of course, you can do more than just listen. You can become part of the action, helping us fly solar sails, discover new planets, and search for extraterrestrial intelligence and life elsewhere in the universe. Here's how to find out more.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. On July 3rd, University of Maryland astronomy professor Micah Hearn got the go sign for the Epoxy mission. This effort will depend on the Deep Impact spacecraft to accomplish two new and very different goals. Mike and his colleagues are still figuring out how to handle the budget reduction NASA has asked for, but he's confident that his probe is up to the dual challenges. Tell us a little bit more about these two missions, perhaps beginning with the what was the Dixie mission, your half of it, to search for a comet. Or not search for a comet, but explore this comet.
Yeah, the Dixie mission was planned to investigate all of the new phenomena that we found at Comet Tempel 1 and find out whether they are a common feature of all Jupiter family comets or something unique to Comet Tempel 1. Whenever one makes measurements in a whole new regime, in our case, extended intensive time coverage, best IR spectrometer ever gone to a comet, and the best spatial resolution ever on a comet, you always get lots of surprising results. And roughly half of the results we got at Comet Tempel 1 were independent of the actual impact. So the impact was incredibly valuable, but there were all these other unanticipated discoveries, frequent outbursts, big differences in where different gases come out of the nucleus, very clear evidence of large-scale layering on the nucleus. And all of those things need to be followed up on some other typical Jupiter family comet in order to make sure that when we try to interpret them in terms of the origin of comets, we're not interpreting an outlier or an oddball comet.
Yeah, it's always nice to have more than one example in your data set.
Right. And Comet Botan is a little bit closer to the sun than Comet Tempel 1 was, makes the observations a little bit easier. We have a superb geometry on approach. We go by at almost exactly the same speed we flew past Comet Tempel 1, so the sequencing is very similar to what we did there. We just have the instrument better in shadow, and we anticipate that this will be entirely like the Tempel 1 encounter in execution, but with different science coming out of it.
With nothing thrown at this particular comet.
Right. We can focus more on the natural activity of the comet since we're not creating any activity of our own.
And you said that this will be in December of 2008, only about a year and a half from now.
That's correct. In order to get there, we have to do an Earth flyby. That will happen on New Year's Eve of this year, and we use that to set the spacecraft on the trajectory to Comet Botan.
Will you be doing any observations of our own planet during that flyby?
The main thing we will do during the flyby is to observe the moon, and this is to provide flat field calibration sources for the infrared spectrometer. Shortly after we fly by, we'll look back at the Earth. And then as part of Drake Deming's project, we will characterize the Earth as a remotely sensed body so to provide better calibration for simulations of what the Earth should look like around another star.
And that's a good segue into this other part of the Epoxy mission, formerly known as EPIC. I mean, we'll have to find time to talk to your colleague, Drake Deming, at some point about how his study will work. But can you give us a little capsule explanation of how deep impact will help to possibly discover extrasolar planets?
What we are going to do during the EPIC phase of Epoxy is to look at stars that are known to have large Jupiter-sized planets in fairly close orbits, which transit in front of the star, causing dips in the brightness. We're going to look for much smaller planets around those same stars by looking for much smaller dips in the brightness and by looking at the changes in the timing of the eclipses by the large planets that are produced by the gravitational tug of the small planet on the big planet. So these are the two key things that we will be doing. We have a big advantage over other systems because we can observe 24 hours a day for weeks, something like Hubble can't do because it's in orbit around the Earth, and in only small parts of the sky can they do this. Furthermore, this takes advantage of the fact that the high-resolution camera on deep impact is slightly out of focus. This means that we can collect a lot more photons from the star before we saturate the detector. So we have much less readout noise compared to the signal and have a much stronger signal and therefore higher signal-to-noise ratio in looking for these very weak eclipses.
Yeah, my colleague Emily Lakdawala in her blog called this a terrific example of turning lemons into lemonade, that it actually, this spreading of the image of these distant stars across more pixels on your camera is actually very beneficial, as you've explained.
Right. If one were doing this seriously with a full-up ground-based telescope, you might choose to consciously run the telescope out of focus to do the same sort of thing. We don't have that control, and generally when Hubble Space Telescope looks at these extrasolar transiting planets, they don't run the telescope out of focus because they don't want to disrupt it for other observers.
Well, one way or another, Mike, it looks like this incredibly successful spacecraft that generated one of the most exciting events in deep space we've ever seen is going to be keeping you busy for a while longer. Is the spacecraft generally in good shape, in good health?
As far as we know, it is. We wake the spacecraft up roughly every 6 months. It's been in hibernation since July of 2005. We wake it up roughly every 6 months and check the basic health of the overall spacecraft. We haven't turned the instruments on for 2 years. They were in perfect shape when we turned them off, so we presume they are still in perfect shape also. We'll really know this at the beginning of September when we fully wake up the spacecraft and test all of its functionality and test all of the instruments. But as far as we know, everything is in good shape.
Well, we certainly hope so. Are you pretty confident that once you get through these meetings at JPL and elsewhere that you'll be able to meet NASA's expectations regarding the budget reduction?
I think so. We have a long way to go. We can certainly get a large part of the way towards meeting them. It remains to be seen whether we can get all the way there or not. And, well, that's the challenge over the next few weeks.
Well, we'll wish you luck both down here on the ground and up there at the Deep Impact spacecraft, and hope that over the next year and a half or so, we will see that spacecraft returning a lot more science back to us here on Earth.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much, Mike, and I hope we can check back with you again as we get further into this. And as I said, we'll probably want to check in with Drake Deming as well. Mike Ahern has been our guest. He is the Distinguished Professor of Astronomy at the University of Maryland, who served as principal investigator for the original Deep Impact mission, and is also serving in that role for this new combo mission called Epoxy. And we will be back with Bruce Betts for another look at the night sky in this week's edition of What's Up after this return visit from Emily.
I'm Emily Lakdawala, back with Q&A. What will happen to the solar system when the sun turns into a red giant? The massive outpouring of energy from the sun will sear Earth, but will also bring welcome warmth to more distant locations. The best places to be when the sun bloats up will be the presently icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn. At Jupiter, the surfaces of Europa or Ganymede could melt, creating warm oceans at temperatures comfortable for Earth life. Even at more distant Titan, the presence of ammonia and the heat of the red giant sun could create frigid oceans, inhospitable for Earth life, but perhaps acting as a cradle for a new type of Titanian life. However, the window of opportunity is short, only a few hundred million years. The sun will rapidly consume its remaining hydrogen and helium and shrink into a much less energetic white dwarf. The outer reaches of the solar system will cool, as will the charred cinder of Earth, and any blooming life in our solar system will be over. Got a question about the universe? Send it to us at planetaryradio@planetary.org. And now here's Matt with more Planetary Radio.
It's time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, joins us once again. Hey, good to see you in person.
I hear you had some religious encounters today.
Religious encounters? Oh, you're right, we did. I was up on Mount Wilson, where it was very hot, with one of my daughters, Claire, who's sitting next to you.
Here, right now. Hi, Claire.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi.
And the wife, who's sitting out in front on the porch here at Planetary Society headquarters.
You didn't let her in?
No. She didn't wipe her feet. And she, we were up next to the inside the enclosure with the 100-inch telescope. Made a little pilgrimage up there to old Fast Eddie Hubble's chair. You know, they have the wooden chair sitting there where he used to sit and find out the universe was accelerating.
Well, I'm glad you made your pilgrimage.
Actually, he didn't say it was accelerating. That's a little more recent, but he did know it was expanding.
Sure.
It's very cool. It's his chair sitting there.
It's his chair where his genuine
was.
That's great.
You better tell us about the night sky.
I better, yes, if there's any hope left. You can still catch Venus and Saturn, but not for much longer. We just have a few more weeks before they're going to duck into the sunset. So shortly after sunset, look to the west, and low down there, the really bright object will continue to be Venus, Saturn slipping away lower to its right.
Can I mention that we are getting responses to your invitation for photos of Saturn and Venus in conjunction in the sky, which was quite spectacular. And I've already gotten photos, got some great ones, actually, from John Leese, who's a local. He was up at the Griffith Observatory here in L.A., taking pictures up there where there were a whole bunch of telescopes looking at this.
Most excellent. I'm glad.
But you want to
go through these. Yeah, we'll come back to it next week. And,
okay.
If anyone else took pictures, go ahead and send them to us. In the meantime, I will mention with Venus, speaking of telescopes, if you check it out over the coming weeks, pull out your telescope, Matt, and check it out because it will become more and more of a crescent.
Mm-hmm.
Spiffy and Yield telescope, something you don't see looking out towards the outer planets usually. Well, ever, really.
I never thought about that, but of course, that's true.
About that. We'll recycle it as a random space fact and discuss the whole geometry.
That's good. Just wait 3 months.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. And you can also check out Jupiter pretty much in the south or north, depending on your hemisphere, in the early evening, looking also like a very bright star. And you can check out in the pre-dawn Mars, looking dimmish and reddish and hanging up there. And it'll start to brighten over the coming months. Speaking of bright red objects, check out Antares. It is near Jupiter. So if you find Jupiter, really bright object in the west-ish, south-ish, in the early evening, the bright reddish star not that far away is Antares, the super giant humongo star we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
There's your sky. Let's move on to Random Space Fact!
What are you laughing at?
It's exciting live, isn't it? It's like a dream come true.
It is. I'm actually here.
And he actually makes his voice do the echo. People think we had that after the fact.
Yeah.
It's all box live.
But the actual random space fact, we've got dawn launch scheduled This is one that Emily pointed out to me. It's discussed more at planetary.org and Mark Raymond's blog there. But they have, it's one of the examples of the weird things you have to think of when you fly a spacecraft. They have 425 kilograms of xenon propellant on board in basically what amounts to a liquid form. In the part of the launch process, they spin up the spacecraft. Well, the liquid spins more slowly and therefore slows down the spin of the spacecraft. And the spacecraft speeds up the xenon and they have to model it and create models to make sure that their spacecraft crafts doing what they want. So it's, you know, this rocket science is sometimes rocket science.
I read that on Emily's blog, too. That was so fascinating. It was really interesting. And, of course, if people missed it, listen in to last week's show. Mark Raymond is the featured guest. So he'll tell you all about Dawn.
Exactly. On to the trivia contest. We asked you this somewhat different question. What space shuttle mission patch is most similar to the current Planetary Society logo? How'd we do? How was the consensus? Did they see the vision as I did?
Well, you're lucky because this was open to some interpretation, but your interpretation did match the majority. We got lots of entries. I was surprised. I thought the people would be put off by this because they had to go somewhere on the web and find patches, pictures of patches. But some people said STS-30, which, you know, is a solar system with a ship, a caravel, as my daughter pointed out earlier.
Which is in the Planetary Society logo.
Yeah, right. People should go to planetary.org and they can check out the logo. But really, there was a definite consensus, definite plurality, if not majority, for STS-49.
Yes, indeed. The first launch of Endeavor, and therefore they made a reference back to the ship Endeavor. And what really solidifies it is the swoosh from the space shuttle, in this case, swooshing by. But in the Planetary Society logo, it's kind of representing an icy ring, but has that similar kind of look to it.
John Anderson of, now can I even find where he is? I sure can, of Northern Ireland. He actually submitted three patches, STS-4, 30, and 49. Luckily for John, his number came up in random.org, and he said he was going to go with STS-49. Good on ya, John, because that is the answer.
And he'll get a Planetary Radio t-shirt. And if you want to win a Planetary Radio t-shirt, tell us the answer to this question. What was the first science return from NASA's Discovery program? So which spacecraft at which body that wasn't the Earth returned the first science from NASA's Discovery program of semi-low-cost missions that they started up in the 90s. Go to planetary.org/radio to find out how to send us your entry.
I think we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there in the night sky and go out there in the night sky.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
I'd like that.
Go out there and look up in the night sky and think about, Claire's here. How about you? What do you think, Claire?
I think that you should think about your local community theater company doing small, low-production Shakespeare plays.
Low-production?
I mean, low-cost production, naturally.
Okay.
But the actors aren't paid, and so usually the shows during the summer are free, and it's a fantastic way to go out and look up at the night sky.
They're under the stars.
And then look forward and watch some Shakespeare.
Oh, well done. Well done.
Thank
Brava.
You.
All right. Well, do that. I don't suppose you have any connection to this kind of thing.
Oh, no.
Okay.
If you're in Long Beach, next weekend it'll be closing. Romeo and Juliet, she plays Juliet, Long Beach Shakespeare Company. In front of the Long Beach Aquarium.
Shameless plug.
Thank you very much.
But soft. Thank you. Good night.
Not a soft plug, a pretty hard one. And that was Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, joined by... it is the East. Never mind. Odds bodkins. Methinks we overlooked something. The deadline for the new Space Trivia Contest is Monday, July 16 at 2 p.m. Pacific Time. That's Monday, July 16 at 2 p.m. Pacific. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California. All's well that ends well. Have a great week, everyone.